Hello and welcome to the American Compass podcast. I'm Orrin Cass, Executive Director at American Compass, and this is Policy in Brief, which, as our loyal listeners know to guess from the name at this point, is a brief discussion of a policy. Today's topic is pro-worker bankruptcy reform, and joining me as always, a man bankrupt in too many ways to count, our Policy Director, Chris Griswold.
Thank you for that, Orrin. Thank you. Hi.
It's good to have you with us. What do you have for us today?
Well, as you said, we're talking about how to reform the bankruptcy code to be more pro-worker. We're putting workers ahead of Wall Street when firms go bankrupt. And the way to do that is for Congress to amend the bankruptcy code and establish a primary financial obligation to workers and also to local communities and suppliers that businesses work with. And we can get into the details of how that might look. But I think the two things that are really important to say at the outset is one, just for listeners who may be less familiar with how bankruptcies go down, there is an order to who gets paid out in a given bankruptcy proceeding. And that order is determined by the rank of each player's claim.
Well, and let's even back up one step from that. What does it mean to be going bankrupt? It means if we're talking about a corporation, the entity is essentially saying we cannot pay everyone all of the money we owe them. Mm-hmm. And so then, as you were saying, somebody has to step in. Some contract is getting broken somewhere. Right. Somebody has to step in and say, okay, who's getting paid what and who gets left with anything at the end of the day?
Right. And the bankruptcy code and bankruptcy proceedings, bankruptcy judges are all kind of meant to bring order to the chaos of that feeding frenzy that results when everyone's trying to get paid out. And so if that's the first thing, is just to bear in mind that there's an order and that not everyone can, by definition, not everyone can get paid. You pay out until the money runs out. And so someone's left holding the bag. Two, I think it's important just to be clear that order, and to the extent that order is determined by law, it's a policy choice. And we don't particularly do a good job as a matter of policy prioritizing the interests of employees of firms that go bankrupt, of the local communities in which those firms are based, and the suppliers and contractors they work with.
Yeah, I think that's a great overview. Two things I'd add before we jump in on why do we need this in the first place. One is when you're hearing talk of bankruptcy, especially in the corporate context, you'll hear about two kinds, Chapter 7 and Chapter 11. And the important distinction here, most bankruptcies are going to be Chapter 11 bankruptcies. Way to think about that is that the firm is worth more alive than dead, that it can't meet its obligations currently, but that there is some hope if given more time that down the road it could get back on its feet. And so in those situations, you want to do what's called a reorganization. Mm-hmm. You want everybody to get together and say, look, rather than all demand our pound of flesh now, which might leave the company truly broke, let's agree on where we're going to take what's typically called a haircut mm-hmm. on what we're owed, and therefore allow the company to continue operating in the hope that eventually it will be able to make good on most of
right, and I think the relevant point there is that when a company is deciding where can we, sell off our assets, so to speak, I mean, workers are on the chopping block all the time.
Yeah.
And if laying off some of your workers is a way to, help, quote unquote, make ends meet, I mean, that's what happens. And that's why in the instance of a Chapter 11 reorganization, it's still really important to, even though the business is still an ongoing concern, it's important to, in law, place workers' concerns kind of at the head of the stack.
Yeah, that's a great point, that in the Chapter 11 proceeding, everyone's meeting in a room to decide how do we reorganize this thing, who mm-hmm. gets a haircut, one person not in the room, unless under some conditions you have organized labor representing workers and there's a contract and pension and so forth, typically the workers are not in the room. And the extent to which they, quote, take the haircut, meaning
yes,
they lose
right.
their jobs is
right.
not is,
right.
is not part of the
no right sidebar. See our work on getting workers into corporate boardrooms, but that is another podcast. Or
thank you, and so I think and then the last point is that of course the first group that gets wiped out is the shareholders. So why not just do Chapter 11 bankruptcy all the time? First thing that happens is if you're a shareholder, you lose everything. The question is, typically speaking, among those who are still owed after that, how are we going to divide it up? And then just briefly, Chapter 7 is the situation where you're worth more dead than alive. Mm-hmm. Not only is the firm unable to meet its commitments, But looking ahead, the longer it runs, probably the more cash it's going to burn. And so this is the situation where you'd see an outright liquidation. Mm-hmm. And the idea mm-hmm. is, you know, literally let's sell the shelves in the stores to try to pay back as much as we can. And last person turns the lights out, every employee is typically gone.
Right. And I used the term feeding frenzy earlier when you can, you know, it's not hard to imagine how that looks on the ground, right? If you're, say, selling off all of corporation's property and assets in a Chapter 7 liquidation, you've got this pot of money. Everyone wants a piece of it. Well, who gets left out? Who gets screwed? Who gets paid? That's the question on the table.
Yeah. All right. So we can tell Chris is chomping at the bit to get to the actual underlying problem here.
which is
the effect on workers. I want to say one more thing before I let you wax eloquent on the underlying challenge that's important to understand, I think, which is, you know, as Chris described, I think exactly right. You've got this hierarchy in which things are supposed to be paid off. There are specific ways that workers are entitled to something. Typically, that comes down to their most recent paycheck. Mm-hmm. So if a company goes bankrupt and hasn't paid workers the wages they are already owed, workers will typically be at the front of the line to be paid that. If suppliers haven't been paid for things that they have already sold to the customer, a lot of times they will be at the front of the line for that. What we are talking about is beyond that immediate, no, I've already done the work for you, where is my payment?
Yes.
Who gets paid in the broader scheme of the obligations that the corporation has to everybody that it interacts with.
Right. And there are really two problems in view in my mind. One is the immediate obvious problem, and the other is a systemic problem about the relationship of risk and reward. So let me take a crack at the first, and then maybe you can get into the second. I mean, the first is quite obvious. It is extremely costly for a working family to be employed at a firm that goes bankrupt. And all of the research makes quite clear that it is not terribly easy to recover from that. It takes a long time to get back on your feet. You often are earning less after the fact. And the same goes for local municipalities and localities that have been relying on a tax base that is no longer there. Those two constituencies are constrained by geography in a way that a corporate entity is not. And more importantly, the kind of institutional investors or private equity firms, so on, that might own that corporation are especially not. And that's what I want you to get into in a minute. But these groups are not able to move easily. A local town government can't move by definition. Working families, it's not an easy thing to pick up and leave and move and kind of recover from the loss of your job. And so putting these groups at the top of the stack in a more intentional and serious way has an immediate benefit of offering them some protections. So if, for example, in addition to the kind of you have to pay what you owe your workers for the work they've already done, if corporations were liable, say, for 6 months worth of salary, in the case of a liquidation for all their workers, in the case of a Chapter 11, you know, for those workers that you choose to lay off during the proceeding, you could say 1 year tax liability for the local municipality. That offers these groups immediate protection. And that's the obvious problem being solved, because I mean, this harms local communities and workers all the time. But the bigger question is the way in which ownership structure in the U.S. Disrupts the healthy relationship between risk and reward. And this proposal would address that as well. So I'd like you to spell out that problem and then how this relates.
Yeah, I think the best way to do that is to go back to our friend Adam Smith and start with how we sort of have in our heads capitalism is supposed to be working, which is basically you've got a capitalist who owns a business and employs people in that business, and we want that capitalist to take risks. And when that capitalist takes risks and succeeds, he benefits significantly. And if he takes risks and fails, he faces a significant cost. And, you know, the bankruptcy obviously is incredibly painful for the workers and the community. It's also incredibly painful for the capitalist. And so whereas certainly there are different and competing interests in that formula, we expect at least to some degree that the capitalist's decision in the kinds of risks he's willing to take will be relatively well aligned with the kinds of risks mm-hmm. we want to see people mm-hmm. taking mm-hmm. that are going to be healthy for the general prosperity.
And to some extent, all these groups are kind of in the same boat, as it were.
Yes, that's exactly right. What you have in 21st century America is a very different situation. You have a situation where ownership of companies and decisions made about how much risk to take, particularly in what's called the capital structure, so how much debt to take on, how many commitments to make, because when you take on more debt, you potentially are able to earn a bigger return as well if you're the owner of the company, but you're also leaving yourself with a lot less flexibility mm-hmm. if something goes wrong. What we've done is create a system where as an owner or an investor, you're able to greatly diversify your holdings. So think about the private equity firm that says, well, we're going to place bets on 30 companies. Well, now your incentive is actually to take significantly more risk in each of those mm-hmm. 30 companies. In fact, if you what's called lever up the companies, take on a lot of debt in all 30, and you accept, look, three are going to go bankrupt, the other 27 are going to produce a bigger return than they otherwise would, that could be a net win for you as a private equity investor. Mm-hmm. And if you're the pension fund or sovereign wealth fund, whatever mm-hmm. other abstract entity is sitting behind that, putting the money in, you say, that's great, that's exactly what I want. Well, if you're the worker or you're the local community, to the point you made a minute ago, you can't diversify like that.
No,
The worker can't say, well, I'm going to go take 30 jobs so that—
Or live in 30 towns.
That's right. So I'm going to— three of them I'm going to lose and the other 27 I'm going to get a raise and that's great. And so what you end up with is this, I think, very dangerous asymmetry where you have the— you have investors, you have the financial system generally putting significantly more risk into the system mm-hmm. that, again, we would say in economic terms, quote, pays off mm-hmm. and is, quote, rational mm-hmm. and, quote, efficient insofar as it generates the highest expected return, but in the process leaves much higher risks on workers with, by the way, no commensurate reward.
Yes, right.
And more importantly, not a risk-reward equation that the worker would generally accept. So even if you say, well, look, you know, the workers in those three companies are going to lose their jobs, the workers in the other 27, they're going to get slightly bigger raises. Now, mm-hmm. not actually yeah. true that that the private equity firm that's doing better is necessarily giving raises. In fact, the data might suggest the opposite. But even if that were the case, that's not necessarily optimal. In fact, I would say it is not optimal for workers, generally speaking.
Right. And just, I mean, listeners know we love a good stat. Just to put a number on it, corporations that are acquired by private equity have 10 times a higher chance of going bankrupt than corporations that don't or businesses that don't. That is a massive amount of risk to lay at the feet of employees. Just to give a sense of the scale of the risk that you're describing.
Yeah, and I think I'll throw in another stat that follows from that, which is, you know, the cost when you are laid off in a bankruptcy, there's an immediate loss in earnings. There's also a long-term loss typically. And so in the spirit of financializing everything, if you think about the net present value, actual cost to the worker suffering in the bankruptcy, you know, it tends to come out to, as best estimate, is about 87% of a year's earnings mm-hmm. just mm-hmm. gone. Mm-hmm. And so the way that bankruptcy is structured today, we say, okay, who does the corporation owe an obligation to?
Yeah.
The corporation owes an obligation to the people that have lent it money. And therefore, if its risk goes bad and it must enter bankruptcy, the obligations amongst which we are going to distribute the corporation's wealth are those groups that have lent it money. Mm-hmm. And what this proposal comes down to is saying, well, wait a minute, that's not actually sufficient. That in fact, there are other groups that employers and corporations have an obligation to, and that's
yes.
their workers and their communities. And if we say that when you go bankrupt, among the groups that you are failing in your obligations to
yes.
are those workers
yes.
and communities, you're going to need to take that into account. You're going to need to compensate them, frankly, before you start compensating your debt holders, then that addresses, to your point, the first problem, which mm-hmm. is just the absolute devastation
yes.
that it can
yes.
cause to workers and to communities. But then it also actually addresses this risk problem. If
mm-hmm.
you are now somebody
mm-hmm.
thinking about levering up a company with debt, if you are a lender thinking about putting money into a risky company, the return doesn't look as good as it did.
Mm-hmm.
And so what it does is it starts to bring the risk-reward balance back toward what we believe actually works well in capitalism.
Yeah, towards something healthy. Yeah. No, exactly. And I think, I mean, in the background here too, and this is also, you know, a theme that runs throughout American Compass's work in other contexts, is just that we do a bad job adequately describing the risk of workers. When you talk about kind of that trifecta of workers and management and owners that all have a stake in how a business turns out, we all pretty instinctively know how to describe the risk that owners take. Are you invest? You put your money at risk. You should, you know, get the return should things work out. Everyone has a conception of that. But we under-describe the risk that workers are. First, as we've already said, in terms of their geographic constraints, you know. But I think also just in terms of like their negotiating power on the front end, right? You know, as you said earlier, you could present all of this to a worker quite explicitly. And if you're the only good job in town, it's not going to matter. They're going to have to say yes and sign on the dotted line. And that's not, in my mind, a particularly real form of negotiating. So, for example, in like nexus of contract theory, which holds that corporations are nothing other than a bundle of contracts of different players to one another, right? That it's insufficient to describe the nature of the risk that workers take. And I think it's just an important theoretical point to put on the table.
I think it's a great point. And to make it a little bit concrete, there's a wonderful essay that Dan Rasmussen wrote several years ago for American Affairs. We'll put it in the show notes about what private equity actually does. Mm-hmm. And you know, there are these claims that it sort of comes in, makes firms more efficient, generates growth, everybody benefits. And he analyzes a huge database of private equity deals over years and years. What he finds is that on all those top line claims, more investment, more growth, higher margins, it's basically a wash. It's a bunch of coin flips, to use a term from coin flip capitalism. But what the research shows that does consistently happen is that private equity firms manage to maintain or even raise output a little bit, mm-hmm. while cutting workforce,
mm-hmm.
and cutting wages.
Yeah.
And that should be the record scratch, you know,
mm-hmm.
record
mm-hmm.
scratch moment, because you can understand why that's good if you are the investor in the private equity firm.
Mm-hmm.
And in the economic data, you'd say, well, they've, quote, increased productivity, mm-hmm. right? The business is continuing to do what it did before,
right.
with fewer workers. But it's not paying the remaining workers more. So they're not benefiting from being more productive. All they've done is reduce employment, reduce wages,
mm-hmm.
and take that surplus and return it to the investors,
right.
who have right. put the additional risk on the company. And the thing I think is so important is to drive home about that, and you were just touching on this when it comes to our concept of risk, is that there's this weird rhetoric, mostly coming from the right of center, that says, well, we should celebrate these, quote, risk takers. And I think it's really mm-hmm. just important to specify what we mean by risk. When we say that a private equity executive is taking, quote, risk and should be compensated for that, quote, risk, he's not actually taking any risk at all.
He has,
in most cases, already been paid a tremendous amount
right.
by the firm and his investors. He will continue to be paid a tremendous yes. amount of.
And as you said, he's looking at the stable of investments, where even if a few go upside down, he's going to be fine in any case.
And guess what? Even if they all go upside down, he's going to be fine in any case.
Yeah.
Whereas the risk that the workers take on,
yes.
through no choice of their own,
right.
with no reward,
right.
is the actual risk right. of whether or not they're even able to support their family.
Well, and I think what ticks me off a little bit is the way in which the American kind of story gets hijacked in the service of this kind of maladaptive behavior, right? I mean, Americans by and large admire the entrepreneur. Right. If you have a brilliant idea no one's thought of before and you're willing to lay it all on the line and put, you know, mortgage your home, get a loan to put your idea into it, we admire that individual and we admire that risk. And most Americans, I think, would celebrate rather than resent the success of that kind of entrepreneur. That's not what's happening in this circumstance. It's not what's happening at all. You've got a set of mechanisms whereby these actors can transfer risk to everyone else, while ensuring their own well-being. And I think it's just really important in response to that objection. Well, don't we admire the risk taker, kind of the job creator, the entrepreneur? That's not what we're talking about at all.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. And it's funny, I think one of the reasons I enjoy talking about this policy in particular is it prompts some of the sort of strongest knee-jerk objections, and they tend to be among the worst objections. And so I think that's one that we need to sort of, you know, reward risk takers in this way. Another one I know.
Well, you could even flip that. I said that's exactly what we're doing. We're trying to reward the workers who, as you said, are taking risk, and communities are taking risk, often through no choice of their own, but are contributing enormous value to the enterprise in question.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So two others I want us to hit quickly. One I'll throw at you is, and you alluded to this briefly at the beginning. Well, this is just interfering in the free market.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Chris, why are you interfering in the free market?
Well, the easy answer is that bankruptcy court is not a free market. It's an institution created by policy to govern the kind of situation that we've been describing, to help resolve claims when all debts can't be paid. And that institution is something to which the parties concerned subscribe when they decide to incorporate a business or decide to go into this line of work, as it were. And as we said already, you know, insofar as the order of payments or the rank of claims is determined by law, that's just a policy choice. And there's nothing at all that says we can't tweak that policy choice to account for the very real and devastating harm that's being done by current practice. But yeah, that's my answer. Bankruptcy court is a court created by policy. It's not a free market, right? In fact, if you're in bankruptcy court, you have already failed in the free market in some meaningful way. So I don't buy that.
That's good. We could set up sort of areas in the forest where bankrupt executives and their creditors could go and sort of just fight it out. I guess that would be the truly libertarian way to unwind a bankruptcy. And we could televise it and use the profits to compensate the workers.
I'm on board. I'm revising American Compass's proposal in this matter.
Stay tuned for our next policy in brief on the bankruptcy dojo. But one related objection I just wanted to hit on briefly, which goes, I think, also to your point about the role of courts in this, is I think there tends to be an impulse when you hear about any sort of policy proposal like this to say, well, this will just create bad incentives and people will work around them, and you're just sort of adding complexity and you won't get what you want out of it. And I think it's really important to emphasize that is a problem already inherent to the bankruptcy system, and one for which no one is more already dug in than creditors. Like, you want to see a bunch of people really maneuvering around the rules and trying to design special mm-hmm. purpose vehicles that are going to get themselves to the front of the line in the bankruptcy. Let me introduce you to the private equity firms and the mezzanine debt and the distressed debt, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, these are incredibly litigious and complex actors. And for that exact reason, bankruptcy law operates with extraordinary discretion given to the courts to actually look to the underlying purpose of the law, to look to the underlying purpose under which various actions were taken, and to, as this is the term of art, unwind what has happened. And so are there ways in which corporate actors and creditors will also try to get money for themselves before some goes to the workers? Absolutely. But that's business as usual, and it's certainly not a reason to say, well, let's just skip the workers and make sure the debtors get all the money.
Right, exactly. So, Oren, what are you going to call this?
Oh, I'm glad you asked, Chris. I would like to call this particular bill the You Broke Act. That's the letter U, Broke Act, and that stands for Undoing the Bankruptcy Risks Oppressing Kind Employees Act.
Okay, I have several questions. Do you mean you broke as in to say you're the one who broke it, or you broke as in you are now broke?
Both. It's a double
entendre. It's an elegant title.
Thank you.
I like it. I went a completely different direction. I'm not quite sure what I got here, but I was experimenting with a little bit of micro-targeting of the various segments of our audience.
Interesting. I'm intrigued.
And fan base. The first is our religious listeners. those inclined to read, you know, the integralists and people of this nature. I've got the People Over Profits Economy Act, or the Pope Act. Here's a quote from Pope Leo XIII from 1891. No man may outrage with impunity that human dignity which God himself treats with reverence. He was talking about workers. So that's for all you religiously inclined listeners out there. Now, for all of our younger meme warrior type listeners, we could just change people to communities and say Communities Over Profits Economy Act, which is the COPE Act. And I would just would really, really enjoy watching private equity rail against the injustice of the COPE Act and then watching all of our meme warrior friends make fun of them on Twitter.
That's very nice. I appreciate it. I'm already picturing the direct mail campaign out to these segments, and I appreciate the savings in just printing COPE Act material and then changing the C to a P with
See, I'm here for you
a
like
Sharpie.
That. I'm here for you like that.
So that is cost-effective. It's compelling. And I believe that brings us to the end of yet another Policy in Brief discussion. Anything to plug?
Yes. Listeners should go to our website and read Confronting Coin Flip Capitalism, which is a paper you wrote, if you recall.
A fine one.
Which lists this among several other proposals, pro-market proposals to for financial reform. They can also read our Guide to Private Equity, which lays out some of the problems and underperformance of that industry, as you alluded to.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, listeners. This has been Policy in Brief, and we will be back soon with yet more compelling policy content on the American Compass podcast.